Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It is safe to say that Amy Smale has had a whirlwind few years. Aged just 21, she left her job at ASOS to found Odd Muse, a fashion brand known for tailoring and sleek silhouettes. She openly admits that she had no experience running a business, yet within her first 3 months, she'd made over £100,000 after her designs captured huge audiences online. Now, Odd Muse is going from strength to strength. I'm sure you've seen them. They are absolutely everywhere. They've just opened their first permanent store in London this year, and I cannot wait for you to hear Amy's story. If you're sitting in a full-time job and you've ever wanted to set up your own venture, this episode is for you. Before we get into the podcast, if you could just go and rate this on whichever podcast app you are listening to this on, it makes a huge difference to the podcast and the types of incredible conversations we're able to have, the types of guests we're able to get on. So, you know, it's probably something you don't think about, but if you could just go rate it now or follow it, it makes a huge difference. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I am so excited for this conversation.
Bet you I'm more excited.
Wow. God, this is going to be fun. So I want to get all into it and find out how where you are now. I'd love to know a little bit about your background. Yeah. Like, tell me a little bit about where you grew up, what it was like.
So I grew up like 20, 30 minutes outside of London in Essex. Very normal background. I remember I was such a tomboy growing up because I was obsessed with my brother. Hated my sister, obsessed with my brother, wanted to be a boy, was into all the boy things. Now I'm like, surpassed my sister in like fashion, beauty, love it all. The love for fashion really come as I was going into university, which is so strange because you'd think I would have loved it all along. But yeah, going into university was when I was like, randomly, I want to be a fashion buyer. That was my upbringing. I loved learning, loved school. I did all the sciences. I loved everything about learning, but fashion only really come into like my earlier life as I was like 17, 18.
And why do you think that was? Like, where did the love for fashion come from?
I think I was like really creative when I was younger, but I didn't really know like where to like put it into. And then I have like a really close family friend who's like a very, very successful fashion buyer. And I just found buying the most interesting contrast between that creativity of fashion, but actually the numbers and like the analytics and the data. So then I just got obsessed with buying, studied buying, went into buying.
Did you study buying at university?
Yeah, I did fashion buying and brand management, which was actually the perfect course.
So useful. What the fuck am I doing here with a fucking music degree?
You have a music degree?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I can tell you so much about the political landscape of music.
It's so funny because when you speak to people, they always have like the most random degrees or their stance is like, you don't have to go uni. I think like uni is such a... don't know, conversation, because you really don't have to go. I was very fortunate that like I was like, right, I want to be a fashion buyer. Like I said, I'd got to like 17, 18, realized I hadn't really done anything in school at all, and I just thought I just wanted to learn about it for a couple years. So it was a very like, it was the least uni experience possible. Like I drove there every day, I lived at home,
right?
It wasn't like I genuinely went there because I wanted to learn about fashion. But yeah, it was literally the most perfect course because it was fashion buying, but it was also brand management. So like part of my final major project was creating a brand start to finish, like branding, product, it was like design, everything all in. And that's where I feel like I've got the first understanding of like A to Z. I really credit my time at ASOS for the experience, but I don't think uni or that experience was more important than the other, because uni really taught me like what it takes step by step. I remember using my final major project brief as a thing for Odd Muse, to start Odd Muse.
Really?
Yeah, like the step by step, like everything we needed to complete, I used that for Odd Muse like a little bit later on.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I've never actually told anyone that.
Well,
here I am.
Thrilled for the exclusive, firstly. Yeah, no, I think that's so interesting because I completely agree that, like, the educational background is less important than the attitude you have towards it and like what you've done with it. And I believe that through everything. So, like, whether that is, I don't know, people I'm hiring, like my personal team at the moment, for example, like we are video editor. I'm sure she won't mind me saying she was an ophthalmologist in her last job and she's just great at video editing. And like, I worked with her for a bit as a freelance and I was like, you're fucking great. And she wanted, like, and I was like, I would. Attitude and work ethic and all of these things are so much more important to me than that type of background, especially because I personally believe that, like, with the right attitude and, like, a thirst for learning, as you've said,
absolutely,
you can work your way into any experience.
Anything. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think I particularly have that approach because I have zero background in what I'm doing as well. So that I'm like, well, if I feel like, because I fucking useless degree. I feel like if I know that I can work to this position and I can put in the effort to do what I need to do here, then why wouldn't I believe that anyone else, like, within their roles can, like, transition in the way that they need to? I'd like to speak about you going to ASOS. Was that your first job out of uni?
That was my first job out of uni. So I was a buyer's admin assistant. So I'd basically be assisting the buying team, raising POs, gold sealing samples, getting samples shot. But it wasn't actually until I got my very last buyer before I left. Her name was Rachel. And she really got me involved in just things that BAs don't do. So I was going to appointments, I was writing orders, and I just felt like I got the best experience with her. So yeah, that was such an amazing, I literally loved that job. The only thing was, like, the progression was, like, quite slow. I caught wind of it quite early because I'd just started and there was just so many, there must literally be like over 500 buyer's assistants in ASOS. Like, it's huge. There's like literally like 6,000 people in that office.
Oh my God.
It's huge. It's huge. There's like two to every department. It's just huge. And I just quickly caught wind. There's a couple girls that had been there for 4 years. They were still BAs. And I don't consider myself like a massive, I'm just not competitive enough to, like, go for that promotion and, like, be against all these girls. And it felt like that environment a little bit, because understandably everyone was a little bit frustrated waiting for that next step. But I just started and I was learning a lot, especially when I got on the team with Rachel. So I was sort of just like, girl mapping the experience versus the money. And then it wasn't actually until I got moved departments that literally, I'm sure everyone at ASOS that knew me probably still speaks about how dramatic I was, but I got moved to the beauty department and I literally acted like my whole world was, like, crumbling down because I was on women's wear premium department. It was immediately, I was like, I'm going to have a brand like this one day. It was all the Australian brands. The department's, like, since, like, gone because it wasn't that successful, but I loved it. I was getting all the samples. I'm pretty sure I was, like, egging that department on just with spirit. It wasn't getting cash. But I was just, it was so relevant to me. And then when I got on beauty, it was just replen orders. I just felt like there was no creativity. It wasn't fashion.
But it's also a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Like, as in, it's just not entirely different.
It's just not what I studied at uni and not what I wanted to do. And everyone was so lovely. Like, they were trying to get me a bit more involved, but I was a BA and I needed to raise POs and I needed to get, like, replen. And then there was, like, talks of, like, their new category opening up and it was, like, I was going to be on, like, sex toys. And I was like, no, this is where I've, like, this is, like, a sign. I can't.
This is the straw. This is breaking my back.
I can't do this. So kicked and screamed, like, was ringing Rachel every week. Get me back on that department. Get me back on that department. Please, please, please. She was really lovely to check in with me every week. Eventually, I get back on the department. This is a really long story. Sorry, guys.
No, that's
fine. It leads into why I left, if that was the next question.
Yeah, no, okay. It is. And also, I feel like this type of stuff is so important to hear because I think that, like, throughout this podcast, I've spoken to so many people who have incredible businesses now or have done incredible things. Yeah. And so many of the catalyst points happened unexpectedly or, like,
so
through things that, like, pushed them into that change.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's always so interesting because I feel like for anyone who's listening, who's going through a change that they weren't quite expecting, I feel like it is incredibly helpful to know.
Everything happens for a reason, 100%. Mm. So I'm back on the department and within 4 weeks, we're all in a big call and the other BA is now being moved off the department, I'm literally sitting there like, that is my fault completely. And I'm an Aries. I feel everyone's pain. I was literally looking at her in the corner like, I am like the evil one here. I literally rang her back straight after and was like, I'm going to quit. I've been like planning this brand like the whole time I've been here. I'm just going to do it. Like, I've had some samples made. I'm just going to go for it. And she was like, okay. I was like, yeah, so you can stay in the department. I'm going to ring Rachel now. She was like, okay. And then that was it. And 3 years later, Alice is now a junior buyer at Old Muse.
Is she?
Yeah.
Oh, so, love that story.
Full circle moment.
That's such a full circle moment.
It was like a crazy 10 minutes. Like, right, went downstairs to my mum and said, I've just quit my job. But I just felt like there were so many things like pushing me to just do it. And yeah. I'd been planning Odd Muse for such a while, like on the way to ASOS. I was just like delusionally confident that it would work. But I was also like, so I just reached a point where I was like, so what if it doesn't work?
Yeah, I'll like, just go back to what I was
like,
doing.
Now's the time. Like, yeah. I live at home. So what if it doesn't work? And yeah, so I just quit my job.
I think that's amazing. And can you tell me a little bit about the, obviously you have some confidence at some point that you've got samples, you're, you know, there's something you can press forward with. It's not just kind of like a seed in your brain. Could you tell me how you even got to that point? Like, while you were at ASOS, what were you doing alongside? How did you find the suppliers?
So I pretty much started ASOS straight from uni. Mm. And I was so excited to have a job. Like, all my friends either were older than me or didn't go to university. So they'd been working for like 4 years. I was finally ready to have a bit of cash. And the pay wasn't great. Mm. And also I didn't really feel like at the time there was any brands that were like either not really luxurious and expensive or just PLT. I sort of come out of uni like, why does everyone assume that younger women just want to buy from Pretty Little Thing or Boohoo or just fast fashion? Like, why is there no one like the Australian brands, for example, that I was working with that are that mid-luxury price point? So this whole time I was thinking like, even the brands that I was working with at ASOS, I was sort of like, I love this mid-luxury price point, but there needs to be something else to justify me to buy it, to invest in it.
Yeah.
So I just come up with this idea of just investment fashion, and it would be that mid-luxury price point like the Aussie brands, but, you know, that you would get more wear out of it because of the design of the product. Mm. And I just felt really strongly about this idea because I felt like I was the consumer living in this problem. So that sort of built on for like a few years, and by the time I got to it, I was like, I'm just gonna do it. I really believe in it, especially the blazer, and that is the product out of the first collection that worked the most. So that sort of solidified my idea to keep going and keep scaling and keep investing in it as well.
So talk to me about even like finding people to even like make the clothes, like making the samples, like getting the first few ones of those back, feeling happy enough with them. I mean, obviously you had the buying experience, so that's hugely helpful, because I remember getting a t-shirt back and being like, well, the body fits, the arms are fucking enormous, and I don't know what to fucking do.
So I obviously, as a BA, you're like tracking shipments and chasing intake. So I knew where a lot of the product was coming from. I knew like what province in, like a lot of the product was coming from China. Mm. I knew what province in China that these mid-luxury brands were going for, because even like China, it's absolutely huge. Mm-hmm. Like all sorts of productions going on there. So I knew sort of that, but then I also knew the first conversations you would have with a supplier from uni. So what's your lead time? What's your minimum quantity order? I'd knew about shipping from ASOS. So I basically literally spoke to like 50 suppliers. Mm. Everyone's favorite question for me is, how did you find your manufacturers? I literally just scaled Google and spoke to like hundreds, and that was it. There's no like quick fix of finding someone. It is literally, I went through so many blazer samples, for example, until I landed on the right one. So it was all just trial and error, basically.
Yeah. No, which I think is very important to know. And I think also like that feels like such a huge obstacle. Like, if I had to count the amount of people who message every day specifically saying, I'm starting a clothing brand, how do you find suppliers? Like, it feels like this like magic question that if you don't know the answer, you're not in the club. Yeah. But realistically, almost every single person, unless you have a huge amount of buying experience or supply or sourcing experience, you are likely to come into this industry not having a fucking clue. And actually, the difference is being able to just, like, quantity when you're going out to people.
I always say to people, like, that is the least of your worries. Yeah. Like once you find someone, like the work really begins. So I think, that is just a Google search, and it's like going through pages and pages and speaking to people. And sometimes it just comes down to like just vibe checking people, like, what other brands do you work with? Like, some people contact us, like, we make for Boohoo, and we're like, no. Or we can tell you what other brands are working on, and we're like, no, because you're going to do that to us. So yeah. I think it's just sometimes it's just taking people through some like non-conventional questions to see if they'll like protect you.
So let's talk about getting to first launch.
Mm-hmm.
You've quit your job.
Yep.
You're going all in on this idea that you've got some samples for.
Yep.
Can you tell me what happened next and how you even got to the point where you were like, we're launching?
Well, obviously, one thing ASOS taught me is it costs a lot of money.
Yes.
To start a brand, especially when you're bulk producing.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, I had to get the money, and ASOS wage wasn't cutting it. So this is a really other random story in my journey. So over COVID, I started making £10 logos. Why did I start making £10 logos? Because everyone had a baking business. Everyone had a small thing going on that they didn't want a mega expensive logo for. I taught myself the basics of graphic design. This is such a weird story. And I was making £10 logos for all the bakers out there.
Amazing.
I was making like 30 logos a day at one point.
Really?
So finishing ASOS, closing my laptop, staying up all night to just make logos. And eventually it was menus for restaurants and brochures and just random stuff. But it got me £12,000 for Obmuse. Yes. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I always just...
My fucking first cookbooks did nothing. Livid. Please continue.
No, it got to the point when I was working for like big industrial companies and making them brochures.
Really?
And I could send, I wasn't charging the bakers too much, but like when it comes to the brochures, I was like putting myself on industry standard. And I remember the last month I did it when I quit ASOS, I'd made like £6,000 just in like graphic design.
Have you ever
considered
continuing that on the side?
No, because I did not enjoy it at all. I was like, it got to a point where people were like, had to chase me. And like, if my heart's not in it, I won't do it. Like, I'm not laughing or learning. I'm not doing it. The goal was to get the money and run.
Yeah. So you got your £12,000.
Got the £12,000. I'm ready to risk it. And the main bulk of my cost was stock.
Mm-hmm.
I was determined to just, one of the reasons why I fell into the founder content was because I genuinely didn't really have the confidence to orchestrate a whole shoot, get photographers in and act like I knew what I was doing. And I also didn't really want to pay for models or anything. So that's how the whole founder thing started. And literally everything else I'd done myself, that £12,000 was all into stock. And I remember I had to buy 50 of everything minimum. But the blazer, I was like, I just really believe in this. I'm going to get 100 units.
It's pretty good for MOQs as well.
Yeah, it is. I can't really find that now.
Yeah, no, I've never found 50 of everything.
Yeah.
Very jealous.
Do you know what it is? And this is a really lovely story with my manufacturers. We started at pretty much the same time.
Okay.
And we've grown so much together. Under 50 is quite rare.
Yeah.
But I just got very, very lucky with her, and we've grown so much together. I got 100 of the blazer, and I just really believed in it. I felt like the rest of the products were just like, I didn't really believe in them. The collection as a whole didn't really make sense, but the blazer worked, and the blazer sold crazily. And I remember we sold like 100 units within like the first launch, and that I broke even instantly on the £12,000. And I had about 700 people who were waiting.
Amazing. And how did that happen?
It was a mix of things, really. So I got quite a lot of attention through the fact that it was just COVID and everyone was on their phones.
So you were doing this founder content. Was it on TikTok? Was it on Instagram?
It was actually on Instagram. At the time, TikTok was just like, we're dancing on TikTok. We're making fluffy coffees.
Mm.
That's all it was. It wasn't really like a business place.
Not making blazers.
Yeah. So I was more actually on Instagram. And I was really explaining my mission. I was like, guys, I know we can't go anywhere, but I'm not selling you like something that you only want to wear this weekend. I'm selling you something that I want you to wear for years and years, and don't just take my word for it. Like, look at the product. Like, when would you not want to wear this blazer? So the actual day of launch, we did quite well. And instantly Pretty Little Thing copied it within like 4 weeks.
Very on brand.
Yep. And I remember thinking, like, that is so annoying. And someone messaged me, like, you have to put this on Twitter. Like, you have to use this as, like, just marketing.
If they're going
to
use it, you might use it too.
So I basically put it on Twitter and it went majorly viral. And all of a sudden I had all these influencers buying the product. And they were, like, tweeting me back, like, I've just bought this. I was like, okay. And then Lorna Lux bought it. And I remember saying to everyone would be like, who do you want to wear your brand? And I would say Lorna, anyone in the world, Lorna, because she was just this creator I followed that I felt like she genuinely just had this like really fab life that she was taking us along for. And she literally bought it, put it on her story, like, just got my shipping notification, like, I'm receiving it tomorrow, I'm going to shoot it in Paris. I wish I had my old phone on me, because I was literally on the floor crying, like, everyone walked in like, what is going on, like, thinking that, and my iPad's just going ka-ching, 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 like Shopify sales. So Lorna Lux has just worn my blazer, and like, her influence is just absolutely crazy because of that thing that I recognize. Like, it is genuine. Like, there's like a twofold with creators nowadays, and I feel like you can always recognize the sort of really influential people. And she picked it up quite quickly, and I credit a lot to her. She's very modest when I say this to her, but she really changed the game for me, and she gave me that exposure early on. Don't get me wrong, I've literally been running ever since that moment, and I chased that stock. I put 700 units on pre-order. I knew these people weren't going to be waiting long. I've been running since that moment, but she really set me up for that, and she really gave me the exposure that I needed. It was like the right time and the right person. And that was the first launch.
Well, that's incredible, and you don't get that without having an amazing product too. Yeah. Like, I think that that same story could have happened. Like, I'm such a big believer in product as marketing.
Yeah. Oh, and absolutely. Like, that's, I think it's core. All in the reaction as well, though.
Yeah,
there's so many people that have like an amazing moment where someone really influential has worn their product, but they don't know what to do. I was like, I am need to chase stock. How soon can I get these blazers? Like, people want them. And then immediately I was like, I need to put them on pre-order. Mm. And that's how we fell into the pre-order model that honestly has scaled my business so much, because essentially for a long time, we are moving out of it now, but essentially for a long time, we've been able to sell as much stock without actually paying our suppliers yet. I'm only just getting into a position where me and my suppliers can actually get on good payment terms, because we've both started so small together. But that's allowed me to like get the full potential out of all these launches, because I'm able to put a lot of stock on pre-order and like de-risk a lot, really.
So what happened is that she obviously posted, and then you basically, obviously in order to be able to take advantage of the fact that she's posted about that, did you already know that you could get a shipment within X amount of weeks, or were you going to work that out after you'd put it on pre-order?
Oh, no, I'd already had the order confirmed.
Okay.
I did this really weird thing, which I put a response box on Instagram and said, leave me your email if you want a blazer. And I had thousands of people, and I manually messaged them all like updates. Like, it wasn't like, didn't even know what Klaviyo was then. Like, I didn't know about email marketing. I didn't know. Now we have like Shopify apps that do all the waitlist for us, but I was doing that manually. And I think that lends to like how personal feeling of Muse has. Because at the beginning I was like, thank you so much, guys. I'm like doing everything. I'm messaging you all personally. Like, this is crazy. And I think it was 2 weeks between Lorna wearing it and me putting 700 units on pre-order. And then that's when we hit 100K. It was like in the first like 2.5 months.
That is insane.
I know. The day I did that pre-order, we took like £60,000. And I remember just sitting on my stairs looking at my mum and dad like, I don't know whether to say anything. Like,
yeah.
I've just made £60,000. Like, how insane. I was literally just sitting on my stairs staring at everyone like, do I say something? What do I do? It was almost like I didn't know how to act. For a long time with Odd Muse, I've not really known like whether to be like happy or like, how to react, because it is just sometimes I from how soon it scoured, I almost got to a point where I found it a bit awkward. Yeah. Like, weirdest thing ever, weirdest tangent ever. But yeah, it was just a crazy moment.
And so you've had this first really successful product, mm-hmm. and obviously that is amazing in mm-hmm. and of itself. What I found through talking to lots of people who have had one like big product that people really loved mm. is that it's obviously really hard to evolve from that point. And mm. especially obviously before that point, that was your first collection. Yeah. So even upselling and kind of going, oh, well, we actually have this that's been a bestseller for a few years or whatever yeah. it might be is really tough. How did you evolve from that first blazer to what was next? And how long did it take you to find, I guess, the next big thing?
I think it's definitely been a journey where I've dipped sometimes with product, but from the first collection, I immediately learned that I was right. Like, I knew the blazer was going to be picked up, and I immediately learned that sometimes it doesn't have to be a big collection. Like, that one product made me £100,000. Like, everything else, it was an 8-piece collection in total. None of the other products mattered. So I remember putting a lot of pressure on myself to build a range, but that sort of scaled me down to, no, I actually just need good refined product, no filler product, good refined product. And it was the belt that really saved me, because immediately I put that into like a jumpsuit and dress version, and they were great sellers. They were flying out. I bought the blazer out in as many colors as possible. I bought the jumpsuits and dresses out as in as many colors possible, and that worked for like a whole year. And then when I started to design new product, there wasn't really much direction. It wasn't to my mission. It wasn't solving any problems that I'd said I'm here to do. And I was surviving on blazer sales. And I just realized it just wasn't sustainable to scale. Like, I hit a point in like 2022 where it was like, if I don't get another good product or get some sort of new direction, this is all going to go. Like, I remember I had to make like one person redundant in 2022, which was really, really rubbish to do. And then it was the pearl dress that was the turning point, really. So we released the pearl dress in Christmas of 2022. And that product alone, just that one dress alone, grossed like 1 million in quarter
Unreal.
Four. So I remember we got to quarter four and we'd only taken about 400K for the year. And then we ended the year on like 1.6 or something like that. Again, it just proved to me that you just have to have that one refined product. And I had to change my direction a little bit, because I was like, elevate every day, wear it all the time. But I wanted to get into party dresses. But then I would constantly tell myself, well, that's not investment fashion. You're not going to wear that every day. But then I was like, no, I want to get a dress that you want to pull out every season. Whether it's a graduation, whether it's Christmas, like, you go for it. And I immediately thought of pearls, like, who I felt like sequins was maybe a little bit too typical, but I felt like pearls were like the timeless odd muse thing, like the belt. So yeah, we released the pearl dress.
Did you know it was going to be a hit?
Yes, because I knew it had that cinch that the blazer had. I knew it had to have that. Everything has to be like quite fit. We always say sophisticated and sexy. So it's not like too much. It's just like the right amount. So I knew it would be successful. I didn't know it would be that successful, especially when we released it in the white as well, which now led us down the bridal route. So that dress changed the game forever, because then we was able to like confidently design dresses for a result. Like, the strapless dress is essentially the sleeves taken off and the pearls taken off, and it's like everyone loves that. And we've evolved so many dresses from that dress, and really we've become a dress brand. Like, 50% of our offering is dresses now.
Amazing.
So yeah, that was like a real turning point.
How long was there between that first identification of that blazer that was, you know, obviously a huge hit, and the pearl dress?
2 years.
So I think that's so important.
Yeah.
Because I feel like especially because like you're doing so incredibly well yeah. now, and like it's so great to see, and yeah. you've done incredibly well throughout your entire journey.
Yeah.
I think what is often so easy to miss when you're looking at other people online and you're looking at the success and looking at like what we often call like an overnight success yeah. and all of this is actually how much it... Like, how much of it were these probably these months and months and months and you thinking like, I'm not going to find an X product. Yeah. I'm not going to find an X product.
I think as well where it started quite strong and now it's strong now, people maybe don't consider that there was like this dip in the middle. And to be fair, like in the middle, like I was still trying. Like I remember I did this big party in LA that I didn't not have the money for. I was still like on socials, you would have thought like Odd Muse is killing it. But behind the scenes, like no one was buying the new product because it wasn't good. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't think people consider that there was that whole like 2 year stint where it was like not good enough.
Yeah, which is every single person's story. Mm. Like I remember one of our biggest announcements came after the literal worst time in our entire business's like lifespan and in my life and like all of this. And I remember as soon as I came out with that and people were like, ah, from strength to strength, like you guys never miss. And I was like, well, we've been missing. Like I've been on the floor begging for like a year and a half now. Like, and
I think it's so funny.
It is really like, and I it's hard as well, because even though when you know that, you still look at other people's things and think like, well, they're going from strength to strength. They're going from strength to strength. And I think these are the conversations I want to have, because I feel like it's so incredibly important. But also from those moments is where like these big successes come from. Because you probably had to dig deep to actually be like,
I always say I had to find out like what Odd Muse wasn't to find out who we are. I had to go through so many products that didn't work and so many colours that didn't work and so many fabrics that didn't work to sort of revert back to my original strategy.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you've done it so incredibly well, and I think that it's like the evolution as a whole makes a huge amount of sense, and being able to find multiple hit products is... it's the name of the game in fashion, but it's also really tough. Like if you look at the comparison between fashion and beauty, almost every single beauty brand has a hero product that makes them sales year after year after year, and they can rinse it in every which way.
Yeah.
And that is just not the case with fashion, which makes it really hard. No. Like as when you think about fashion as an industry, like I always say, like if you want a lifestyle business and you want a business to go and be a digital nomad and be on your laptop right at all, never fucking start a fashion business. Like don't even think about it because you have to strike gold.
Thank
again
you for
and
saying that, because my boyfriend always calls me a digital nomad and I'm like, girl, I'm honestly not. Like, I'm literally pulling my hair out every day. Like, I'm in the most physical job ever.
Yeah, and it's the constant working capital need for the inventory. Yeah. It's the constant need to, like, evolve. Like, you cannot sit on your laurels within fashion. And, like, that's what makes it exciting, because you have more to talk about. But that's also
it's like the best and worst thing.
Yeah, 100%.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
So I'd love to speak about your business now and how your growth and marketing plans are evolving and have evolved, obviously, like since this initial success. Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk first about when you made your first hire.
Yep.
How you knew it was the right time, what role you thought it should be. I feel like that's a big obstacle for people.
I think the first hire is definitely always way overdue. I was pulling my hair out. Family and friends were helping me. It was like a beyond the 100K mark that I got my first hire. And I think any startup business has to be quite comfortable with hiring someone on the basis that the role is going to be a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
I think people really stress that there has to be like one person for this, one person for this, and there's not the budget for that.
Oh my God, at the beginning, we were like, I had like one mini me who would just like help with everything.
Yeah.
Then had one, we literally were like, you're the business person, you're the creative person. Like that's literally what we had.
Yeah, so I had I remember I my first title that I gave was brand support assistant. And she would literally pack orders in the morning, do emails in the afternoon, and do like refunds when they come in, help with some marketing. It was like everything. And it took me a long time to just put that role out, because I was a little bit like, how do I explain this? And as well, you can't really explain to someone in a startup company where their role is going to go. They just have to sort of believe in you more than you believe in them, essentially.
It's a very particular type of person.
Yeah. So that was my first hire. And then my team started to really gradually grow. I remember my university got in touch with me and was like, we've got some interns that really want to work with you. And I took on two interns that are still with me now in like a paid role. So that took my team up to like three people. Then I brought Alice over from ASOS. She actually first come over as like business development manager to help me sort of like manage the team. But this year specifically, we have got all the people we need, and people are able to be in like their own sort of regions in the business.
And how have you found that evolution from having like a really small team to being like 35 people?
It's been quite, I mean, I would say it's happened so naturally. Like the demand has been there and we've hired accordingly. And like one of the reasons I got into this is because I'm so interested in business and stuff like that. So for me, I've kind of loved it. Don't get me wrong, like 35 people's livelihoods on your shoulders, it's a lot of pressure. And, you know, sometimes it can really, you can have a set to-do list and, you know, it sometimes doesn't go that way when you are responsible for that amount of people.
And what does your role look like now?
So my role this year is a lot more refined, but we're still getting there. Mm. My role is technically creative director for, I've got my business is sort of set out into sort of like product and marketing, and I sort of like lead the creatives on both sides. But in terms of product, I'm designing the product. In terms of marketing, I'm in the content. I'm in all the sign-off meetings. I'm really like rolling out all new things that I want to try. But you know, there's also this massive logistical part of owning a fashion brand where, you know, things need to be run past me. And I do struggle with that because sometimes that can just knock my creativity so hard. Like, but it's conversations that I just can't get out of, that I'd be more concerned if I wasn't in. So I'm sort of like, I always say like, I feel like I'm like doing an impossible role, and there's parts of my role that I'm not able to like fulfill as much as I'd like to. But I'm getting there. I'm getting there. I'm a control freak. I want to be involved in it all, and that's the price I pay.
And so what are you struggling with most at the moment in that sense?
I think it is just the creativity when, you know, you're coming out of meetings that are talking about warehouses and logistics and just new freight options. And it's more so that, because people will say to you, oh, Amy, what do you want to, for example, a problem in my week right now, we need to design pre-fall. Like, this is late. We're working with wholesalers now. I need to show wholesalers my August collection literally in 2 weeks' time. And it's like, I can't just be like, right, done talking about freight now. Let's bang out pre-fall. It's not going to work. Odd Muse has never released a product that wasn't well thought out. Well, now we don't. I struggle with just that time that you need to be creative, that time at home where it's just like you come up with even silly things, like you come up with a silly TikTok idea and it just goes mega viral, or just time of nothingness that is actually such a strategy in a founder's role.
Yeah. And how do you think you're going to fix that?
How do I think I'm going to fix that? I don't actually know.
Would you hire someone for the operational side, like a COO?
I actually hired a managing director this year.
Amazing.
And it's been going really, really well.
Yeah.
However, I'm just like, okay, it's going well. Let's expand into the US. I'm going to go view warehouses. So like, I am the devil. I am creating this work for myself. So there's a lot of things that have been taken off my hands, but I'm just creating new work because that's just me.
Nope, you're speaking to one of your own. Yep. So you're all good.
Yep.
I'm sure that
I'm like, don't just fix my problems. Let's start some new
stuff.
Perfect.
We fixed that one. So now we have space to do this one. Yes. And we'll make loads more problems. But I feel like that's one of the incredibly defining parts of being a founder. And like what I constantly try and work out in my head is is this stretched because, like, is my time stretched so far in this way because actually I'm always going to be doing all of these roles?
Mm.
Or do I need to be delegating more? Or do I need to be hiring more? Or do I need to be just letting go yeah. of some of the areas?
Yeah.
And then at the same time, knowing whether it's the right decision or the wrong decision, whether you're letting go and that's a bad thing and the brand's going to suffer because of it,
yeah.
or whether you're letting go and that's a good thing because you're being a control freak about it and you actually yeah. don't really need
it's,
to.
It's a constant battle in your head. It's just like, oh, you could be doing this, or you can justify it in any which way. I always sometimes just say to myself, sometimes when I'm really stressed, like, this is the price you pay. Like, this is what you wanted. This is a sacrifice. There is definitely going to come a point in my life where I'm like, literally, like, life comes at you fast, like 27 in like 2 days. Like, I need to slow down a little bit. But for the moment, I literally have a bad week and then I get back up again.
Mm.
That's what I'm doing, just getting back up again. That's yeah. my only thing I can give, the only advice I can give right now
yeah.
on that.
What do you feel like would make your life a lot easier right now?
Just more time.
Sure.
If possible.
Cool.
There's literally
I'll try and sort that out for you.
Not enough hours in the day.
Yeah.
Because even when I'm sitting there just trying to relax, like at the end of the day, this is my hobby. So I'm on Pinterest. I'm looking at what we could do. Oh, maybe we should do an event like that. Maybe we should. I'm constantly like thinking of new ideas and creating more work for myself. But I do love it. Like I you know, if I have an idea at 10 o'clock at night, I'm staying up for that creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Comes in wins. So yeah, more time would be great. But on a more realistic, if you're asking me a more realistic question, which I'm guessing you are, I'd say time management,
mm-hmm.
which I feel like you're a queen of, like you're scary productive.
I'm only that way. It's the only way it works. Like
yeah.
I said, it's the only way it works in my head. It's the only way it works.
But my thing is like, I can how do you like account on, this is where I'm going to bounce back to you.
Yeah, that's fine.
How do you actually like account for like all the stuff that happens in the day that you did not have on that schedule?
So I build buffers into every single block.
Right.
So like the thing I always say for people starting to time block is like, spend 2 weeks recording how long everything actually takes you. So like
right.
if you're saying, oh, I need to draft this email, and it's not like a, you know, quick little email. It's like a heart, you know, it's like a.
But does nothing one. Like sometimes just think, does nothing ever like annoy you? And you're just like, oh, like you spend like 30 minutes just get. Or just really knocking you off your game.
Yes, 100%.
I can
and
get
that
knocked
just
off
like
game.
Happens and it just like it comes and hits your day and like it's always the case. I do, that's exactly what I build the buffers in for.
Yeah.
So like when I've started recording like how long everything's taking me, I then make sure to basically add in whether it's 15 minutes onto the end of it, whatever it might be. And then you start noticing patterns as well.
Yeah.
Like I have a big approvals block at the end of the day because I will not go home until I know that like every single thing that needs to be approved for that day from the different businesses has been
yeah.
approved. And that's something that I absolutely need to do. So that at the end is always a backstop because I have usually like an hour and a half, 2 hours to bash through all of those every single day.
Yeah.
So often things can like float into that block if I don't manage to get them done earlier in the day. I work this way because I work best this way. And like, I'm a very, like one of the things I suffer with the most is like, I am so hyper-fixated on whatever I'm doing. And so actually this is what allows me to have the amount of structure I need in order to be able to be like, okay, well now you need to do this, now you need to do this, now you need to do this. Because I also find it really, really hard to bounce through different types of things. And that's one of the things I struggle most with in my role. Mm. It's like, okay, I want to tell people about these new trousers we've done, but I also need to sort out this big issue, but I also need to review this marketing plan, but I also need to do this. And I find that really hard to bounce between them. So the way I design my days is to have as minimum of that possible. Today, for example, we're doing 4 podcasts in a row, and that's what we do, and we do this once a month. And so that it doesn't detract from the rest of the work in terms of like having similar work next to each other. But I do feel like it's really about working out where those obstacles are for you and noticing the patterns of like, actually every day after lunch something big comes up, and so I'm just going to save an hour for literally whatever's popped up, and that's going to be basically like my emergency block or whatever it might be. Or on a Monday morning, you'll see that like every single Monday morning I have about an hour and a half to write up master to-dos, block out the entire week and send up everything from the weekend, because I'm like you where I don't want to message people all weekend, but I will have my best ideas when I'm doing less. And so I'll write up literally like a huge amount of like, whether it's ideas, whether it's like pitches, whether it's new projects, whatever it might be,
yeah.
I'll do that all on a Monday morning and then get that out so that people can start actioning them.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's really about noticing the patterns and then also realizing that you're never going to get it fully right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is also obviously very
important. I can just, I can have my like focus affected so much. So I think it's more so for me like protecting that. Like this year I've been spending a lot of time working from home.
Mm-hmm.
It won't, when I first got my new office, it was the office. Sometimes my environment, sometimes my most like winning environment changes. And at the moment that is home for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I just have to recognize like where I'm most focused.
Yeah.
And at the moment it does seem to be more home, going in for meetings. I have a lot of meetings anyway, so I'm not scarce in the office. But yeah,
so what I do for that, for example, is that I know that I'm more focused at home, but I know we make better progress with the business at the office.
Yes.
So I do Mondays and Fridays work from home, and I do them, and I'm very strict about not having meetings Monday morning and trying to avoid meetings at all on a Friday, because it can often get to the point where there are genuinely 9 hours of approvals from the week that have like overflowed into the Friday, so at least I can get through them and like signpost the weekend, otherwise I will never take a weekend. But what I also know is, yes, I'm less productive on a Tuesday to Thursday, but actually as a business we have more of the ad hoc conversations that we otherwise wouldn't have. So it's like grabbing someone in the corridor and being like, by the way, you know, like this, like, shall we do this, that event that we were talking about, I was just thinking we scrap this and do it this way instead. Like, that doesn't need to be a half hour call, and that only gets done when you're, or
in
for
office.
Me at least, with the company, like when people are able to like interact with each other.
Oh, absolutely.
I think it's about understanding what the different aim of each day is, and understanding how much of the week needs to be for focus and how much of the week needs to be for progress in terms of like the stuff that only comes from like in-person conversation.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But it's, again, there's never like a winning answer, and I feel like it changes all the time. I want to talk about your social media strategy.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that is best in class and really exciting to watch.
That's like, I'd say, my favorite part of the role. That and designing the clothes are like my favorite.
Completely agree. Would love everything else to fuck off.
Yeah.
But anyway, and I also won't let
I said that. That was news.
So talk to me about your social strategy and the difference between the brand's social strategy and your social strategy.
So the brand's social strategy is, we're very different on Instagram and TikTok, and we take both very seriously. A lot of brands don't take TikTok as seriously. A lot of brands either do loads of TikToks and don't take Instagram as seriously. When I first started posting TikToks, I gave up on Instagram. I would post, but it was just to tick a box. And the thing with TikTok is it's great, but you have to see it as a bonus. It's not sustainable. So I remember in that like 2022 dip, we were like banking on getting a TikTok to sell jumpsuits. And like when we got a good TikTok, we would sell a lot and it would like save us for the week. But it wasn't sustainable. I wanted consistency. I wanted my daily sales to be consistent. And Instagram really gave us that, taking Instagram seriously, doing what Instagram says, having a twofold between silly little TikToks and a nice, clean Instagram that shows your product amazingly. So that's our strategy that we continue to do. We take it really seriously. And I am in a lot of the content because I just, for the longest time, it is just so constant. Like, you need to like be churning it out. And the only real way I see myself doing that is through me. Like, I'm the most adaptable person in this business. I'll throw rocks at my feet and I will dance. Like, that's why I've been like the most involved. But we've sort of realized it to be a great strategy and we don't really want to get rid of that.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're in sort of talks, okay, how do we show diversity and how do we show our true like intentions while I'm plastered all over the Instagram and the TikTok. My own strategy, something that I've just fell into this year, I've only just started posting on my personal TikTok because I just feel like this year I feel quite confident giving business advice. In the last, like, up until, it's taken me 3 years to feel like, oh, okay, I've done okay, like I can finally feel like I can, you know, tell you what I'm doing and maybe it might work for you. And I feel like the last 3 years I've been on an interesting journey. I've never wanted to, I don't ever want to do things for the sake of it. Like, I didn't want to upload TikToks on my personal in the last 2 years because I just didn't feel like, I didn't want to tick a box. I didn't feel like I had anything to say as such. But now I feel like I'm in this position where, yeah, like I can, you know, we're launched with all these wholesalers. We've done a lot. We've obviously got the store now. I do feel like I've got something to talk about. And that's actually working really well for the brand. Obviously, you know, firsthand, like founder content. I just feel like just gives you, you are always going to be your own competitive edge. So why would you not tell your story? So I've been taking that a little bit more seriously this year as like a bit of a strategic move.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
So TikTok gets the views and ideally converts over to Instagram or website. They're either coming, signing up to the newsletter or they're buying something, which signs them up to the newsletter.
I'd say TikTok
anyway.
Is like our biggest thing for like brand awareness.
Right.
And then they move, like you said, move over to the email subscribers. They follow the Instagram. Mm-hmm. Then that's when you can start getting your followers to not only enjoy your content, but genuinely love your brand and love your product.
100%. And I think that this is one of the big misunderstandings about the different social platforms and kind of prioritizing them in terms of effectiveness, because I feel like that's such a false hierarchy.
Yeah.
I don't think there is... Like, effectiveness is determined by what you are trying to affect. Like, what is your main KPI? If your main KPI is growth or getting eyes on the brand or whatever it might be, perfect, TikTok.
Yeah.
But the problem is with that is that they might buy once or they might sign up to the newsletter and they might forget who you even were.
Everything is like
cycle.
Perfect synergy. Like, okay, they found you on TikTok. What's next?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't just... I've been there and I can guarantee there's so many people out there that are just chasing a viral video.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually getting a little bit too much now. Like sometimes people can
For You page is fucking terrible.
Yeah, everyone's just trying to go viral, like whether they actually care about a scandal or not. Like everyone's just trying to like say something a little bit controversial, or just everyone's trying to go viral. And I feel like I don't really know what the future of TikTok is, to be honest, but you know, you got to be in it to win it. So yeah, that's where we get the brand awareness.
Yeah, and then they convert over to a platform with more longevity, which is generally, I'd assume, email or Instagram.
Yeah.
And then they're able to be tied in again and again and again to new launches, to new content, to new all of that.
Yeah,
I feel like that's such an important thing to talk about.
I feel like email marketing is something that is like arguably more important than like social media. Like at the moment, for a long time, it's been like 50% of our revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And like as standard, I think it should be like, I think industry standard is like 20.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that is something that no one really talks about, like email marketing and looking at that brand loyalty story.
100%. So our email list at Tala, for example, is bigger than any social following.
Yeah.
And that's like very, very intentional.
Yeah.
And I always talk about the fact that like you should be getting someone's email at any single point that you can.
Yeah.
So I think that there's been so much focus in the past few years on followers. And don't get me wrong, obviously incredibly important.
Yeah.
But it's like if you were to go on a night out and meet loads of great girls.
Mm.
And have zero contact details for them.
Yeah.
Like, you might have had the best time ever. They might have thought that you were going to be their best friend for life. They might have thought, like, let's go out again, like, whatever it might be.
Mm.
If you have no way of contacting them or no way of, like, remembering them, then all of you are going to forget. And I think that that's what often with the kind of vanity metrics of social media, of the follows, the likes, the views, it's very, very easy to prioritize that because it's this kind of instant gratification over actual list building.
Yeah.
And I think that's what is like one of the things that I tell people over and over and over again. Like someone talked to me in like a cafe this week and she was like, I'm about to start a like brand and, you know, what would you recommend first and all of this? And I was like, get the emails. I was like, get the, it, like when audience build ahead of launch, but most important part of audience building is getting emails.
Yeah.
And I think that once you start tapping into that, you start feeling like all of these other things are feeding into that rather than you feeling like you have 20 different strategies on 20 different platforms and they all work independently of each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what's worked most successfully for the brand socials?
I would say that point where we, you know, stopped relying on TikTok so much and saw it as a bonus and started taking Instagram quite seriously, because that's when I saw the consistency across the board. daily sales, followers every week. I think one thing I don't think I've touched on as well is like the paid market, the paid social side of things. Like that's really important. And I think you have to have that balance between organic and paid. I think a lot of people miss that as well. But yeah, I'd say it was the point where we started taking Instagram really seriously, because a lot of people gave up on Instagram and just thought TikTok is where it at. And people do think that, like, there's so many creators out there that are huge on TikTok and not so much Instagram, and they make sure to put like their TikTok following in their bio because that's sort of where their following is. But I feel like Instagram is just this longevity piece, like you said. So when I come back to Instagram, that was the biggest thing for both TikTok and like the social as a whole.
And what type of content do you find people really respond to on Instagram?
I think at the moment, obviously it always changes. At the moment, people, they like to see this. I feel like the Pinterest era is coming back, and I'm so happy about that. They love like detailed carousels and like behind the scenes. But they also love, like, we always will post like a reel, and if we have like, it's all in the writing that I put on there. I rarely ever post a reel with like no sort of like hook, whether it's, I don't know who needs to hear this, spring has sprung. I did one the other day, like that journey one that got like 5 million on Instagram. And honestly, that is like getting 20 million on TikTok. Like what that did for the brand. We got like 150,000 followers in 1 week.
Wow.
Which is just crazy. And that was just getting everything from the last 3 years together and just saying when you cinched a blazer and all of this. So I think people like to see the journey on Instagram in an aesthetic way is my sort of strategy at the moment.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that it's also like there's so much, especially when you're selling something, like it's so easy to think that, okay, I'm selling something, this is my marketing, and therefore it all needs to be about specific selling.
Yeah.
And actually understanding how much of it needs to be about education in the journey, in the product, in whatever it might be, to actually have that type of, like, that is what selling is. Like, people are on social media. They're not on social media for themselves. They're not on social media for you. Like, they want to either learn or be entertained or whatever it might be. And actually understanding that that doesn't just mean being like, hi, buy this. Hi, buy this.
Yeah,
hi,
exactly.
Buy this. And it's more about being like, hi, we have this, or this is who we are, or whatever it might be. If that appeals to you, fantastic.
Yeah.
And that will naturally happen if it does. But it's understanding, like, the difference between needing to push that versus needing to, like, attract the type of customer that you want.
Absolutely. I always want our Instagram to be something that people enjoy, whether they buy a product or not. And I think that strategy lends to just like people organically coming to Obmies.
Let's talk about physical retail.
Okay.
You launched your first store not that long ago.
November.
How did that come about?
So I actually did a pop-up shop a year ago in a similar sort of area in Covent Garden. And that went really well. And I just, from that, I just immediately wanted a permanent store. I was like, sign me up on a 5-year lease. I'm ready. And also with the pop-up, you obviously can't do too much to it because, you know, there's no point like kitting out a shop that you got to move out of so soon. So I really had this passion to like make something my own in London. Like I wanted to paint it pink and I wanted to do all this stuff. And The effect that the pop-up had on my brand, even on socials, was insane. It did everything for the brand as a whole. When we opened that pop-up shop, our daily sales increased by a lot. And that was just because I like to do things that add credibility to the brand. And I feel like a physical presence adds a credibility. I felt like when we did runway, that was adding credibility. I feel like Harvey Nichols and launching with other, it's all in the credibility of the brand, and it's just doing different things that isn't so typical for an e-commerce brand. So pretty much it was a pop-up that led to, okay, I want to now say to people, I'm opening a flagship. And I think the next step for that is like, I really want like an international store. I really want a store in the US. I always want to be doing like, what's the next thing for like the credibility of the brand? But It's just done amazing. Like I just can't believe that, you know, a physical store could, because I don't know, like even when I think back to when we opened Pop-Up, like we're used to like so many people being on site and checking out at one time online because there's just no cap on that. And physical stores, it's a very different experience, but it's just been so good for the brand.
Yeah. And have you found that's because people have gone down and seen the products and then come back and shopped online or discovery or?
I think it's the best part about it is it's all of the above. Like people either discover the brand, people walk in like, oh my God, I've seen you on TikTok. There's just all types of customers that walk into that store. And it's just been the best experience, but literally all of the above. Like there's just so many different types of Oddmuse customers that walk in. And it's funny to see the pattern. Like anyone who's not heard of the brand will walk in and buy a blazer. A lot of them will then go online and get a dress. Anyone who's heard of the brand already has a blazer, so they walk in and buy a dress. Like just the patterns and everything is so interesting.
Yeah.
And just the fact that it is just pretty cool that I have a pink store in Covent Garden.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. Did you feel scared signing that 5-year lease?
No. I don't get scared until like it goes down the pan.
Yeah, no, fair. I mean, it makes sense. Do you want to scale the business at any point soon to a point where you are less involved than you are now?
I don't really know. I'm really loving getting more and more people involved and hiring more people and getting people's input and handing things over. That's where I'm at the moment. I do find the whole like scaling and that quite interesting, but I just don't personally feel like I know enough about sort of if I was to go out to investors and stuff like that. But for the moment, I'm happy in the direction it's going. Mm-hmm. My ideal world would be me being sort of like in the social media and having the time to creatively design the product and like all the logistics stuff.
Separately.
Yeah.
That can...
Because sometimes I'm literally like, I'm being asked big questions and I'm like, I'm not smart enough for this today. I'm so sorry, I've not woke up smart enough.
Literally every day. But also like in order for you to be able to do the things that have made the brand so special, you need to be able to free up headspace and mental load.
Absolutely. Like one of the things I say is like the product to this point has been like so to my taste. I've been all the content. I really don't know anything else. So I need to protect that as much as I can while I explore what might work. Like this social campaign we're doing next week, that's a big test for the brand. And I really hope it will work and I really think it will work. But yeah, I think I would have to reassess my involvement in the social media. I don't want to be like, you know, doing the shoots all the time and then doing the live before we launch and all stuff like that. Definitely want to share my responsibility in that realm, but I always want to be involved personally in the content.
Yeah, no, completely understandable. I want to talk quickly before we end about general founder life and how you find it and what you find great and what you find awful. I'd love to know what your hardest moment has been as a founder.
My hardest moment, and I really hope my mum and dad don't watch this because I'll tell you. My hardest moment was when sometimes I can go a little bit far with how confident I am in the brand. And last year I decided I wanted a store in Dubai.
Okay.
Got very far into it, signed a lot of things I shouldn't have signed. And I ended up losing around £55,000. Yep. And the reason I had to leave was because total investment was going to be like way over like £400,000 just to kit out a store. Don't really know why my London store was like not.
Yeah, that just sounds expensive.
It was like a whole, they were talking to me like, yeah, like £400,000. And I'd be like, and immediately all I could think was, I've only just come out of that because there was a window of time where I thought I was committed to that £400,000 and I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I was up all night. It was the worst point. I was far too embarrassed to tell my mum and dad. My sister was also crying herself to sleep. Like I honestly thought I was done. And that was like a really hard point. Like that was so scary for me because it's actually like, I feel like there was something in that really say, I really hope my mum and dad doesn't watch about me losing £55,000. I keep thinking about that. there was something that happened that saved me, and it was I was supposed to hand over all the checks for like the lease for the whole 4 years. This had nothing to do with the £400,000 fit out, but I was supposed to hold out a sign monthly rent checks for the whole 4 years. For whatever reason, I could not get that checkbook. I had a courier bring it to my hotel. I opened the envelope and it was empty. And it was all this big stress the day before I was leaving. And I left Dubai and I couldn't sign them checks. If I would have signed them checks, I would have been in it for 4 years, no matter what, even if I couldn't pay the £400,000 fit out. So yeah, there was that window of, I didn't know that until later. Like, it would have been like highly illegal if I didn't pay all that rent while, if I've signed checks. So that was the first time I got myself in to some really hot water.
And what did you learn from that situation?
I learned to read what I'm signing.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned not to let people rush me, mm-hmm. because we wanted that store in Dubai. And I remember like this guy rang us and was like, this never comes up. Like, this is the best opportunity. We need you to like do all this. We need you to get like a 3D drawing of how you're going to set out the store. We need you to present yourself. And I was like, wow. Like, they was like, they really want you. Like, and I was just caught up in it all, and I didn't actually consider, okay, is this now everything before I go into anything? It's like, right, how long is it going to be to like return on investment? Like, I've changed the way I go into things so rapidly. But that was probably the lowest point in probably my life, because I was far too embarrassed to tell everyone and also worry people. Like, I didn't want my mum and dad thinking that I was going to be banged up abroad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, sometimes I go back to it. I'm like, oh, why did I do that? Like, I feel like so stupid. But we live and learn. I'm over it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like those things do take a long time to get over. And I feel like it's exactly those things that make you, that you're most embarrassed about, and you feel like, why the fuck did I do that?
Yeah.
And how did I get myself into that situation? That are also the things that make you a great entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Because there will also be things that you look at and you're like, that didn't make any sense, and I did it and it worked.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I mean, my whole three years has been like rushing into things and it working. And that was the first time I rushed into something that it didn't work, and it was a huge lesson. Like, yeah. I would never do that again.
But exactly that, it was a huge lesson.
Yeah.
And I feel like everyone could have told you that, and everyone could have said, like, you know, don't do this and think more about it. And until you make that mistake, you're not going to know that lesson. And I do think that it probably just needed to happen. And like, sure, it's an expensive mistake, but 55,000 is not the same as 400,000. And if that had sunk the rest of the business, then, and it sounds like there were a huge amount of red flags from those, like, from those people, and ultimately no fit out needs to cost 400,000 if you don't want it to. You can have a fucking single rail in a store, unless it's like within a specific place where they have, you know, like they have specific way it needs to look, and then that should have been transparent from day one.
It was just a bit of a hellish time, to be honest. But yeah, I felt like I've learned so much from it.
And how have you grown your confidence over time in terms of these types of things, or in terms of the brand as a whole?
I think Odd Muse's success has really helped with that. Like, each year we go by, I'm like, okay, I know what I'm doing. Like I said, this year I'm not really on my TikTok. Like, it's taken me 3 years to get in front of the camera and actually speak about me and my journey, which is weird because I've always been in the content. But I think at the beginning, I knew I was timid, but I had really big dreams, and I knew that was going to be like a nice story. So I just pushed myself to like be on the Instagram, even though I was like, thank you so much. Like, I don't know what's going on. And I've grown it like quite naturally through the years. And it's just through just feeling confident that I know what I'm doing. But yeah, I was so timid when I started Odd Muse. Like,
and what advice would you give to yourself at that time if you could go back and like talk to her?
I would give the same advice I gave to her back then, and just to just go for it. Like, I really put myself out there to be the, I think how like sort of timid and shy I was, like, really translated to people just wanting to support the journey. Like, the product was also good, but, you know, it was this girl that just left ASOS and was just like really just trying her luck. So yeah, just to like go for it, because I feel like people are really now doing that on social media and it's a great thing. But anyone who, you know, perhaps hasn't got that like burst of energy yet, it is just not caring what people think and just going for it. So what if you fail?
Yeah. No, I think that's so important. And what's the next big thing? And what are you most excited about as a whole?
I'm most excited for our US expansion. Because I was, Odd Muse was a lot bigger in the US before the UK. We only really caught the UK with the Pearl Dress. Like before that, I was sending all my orders to the US. So I'm really excited to just be out there and fulfilling orders. And I really want a store out there. I've been on the hunt for ages. And yeah, it's all in the US for me at the moment.
Exciting. Yes. Well, I can't wait to see it. Thank you so much for joining
me. Thank you. I really enjoyed that.
You've been fab. You're amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.